clerk will call the docket.
Samuel Fitzgerald against Christine Lee Benow, Jacob A. Cameron for the appellant, Paul T. Walsh for a fire J. Mitchell, please tell me.
Good morning. May it please the court. Your honors, of course, this case was...
And your name is?
Jacob Camero, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I apologize. Jacob Camero for the appellant. This case was dismissed below because it was filed in the name of the plaintiff and not in the name of a guardian, even though a guardianship had been entered in the Circuit Court of Loudoun County. And I maintain that there was no question there was a guardianship that was filed in Loudoun County, and it was granted by the court there prior to the filing of this lawsuit. However, that guardianship was, in the way I look at it, was limited for medical or personal decision-making only. She had a medical condition, and the guardians were, there was a petition for guardianship. The petition was granted by the circuit court. Interestingly, there was no, and it occurred to me in preparing for this argument, there was no conservatorship also petitioned for in the circuit court. It was just a petition for a guardianship. The court in Loudoun County clearly found that Ms. Lopez was incapacitated, but the statute 64.2 now, the current section 64.2-2000, that has the definitions, defines incapacitated person, and it differentiates between a guardian and a conservator. And this is not an issue that I addressed in detail in my brief, but it occurred to me in preparing that there is a different definition for a conservator. An incapacitated person, of course, is someone who is found by the court to be incapable of receiving and evaluating information, etc., to meet the essential requirements for their health, safety, care, or therapeutic needs without the assistance or protection of a guardian. So it's just personal issues such as medical issues.
May I interrupt you there? But the court's order found a permanent incapacitation not only for care of the person, but administration and management of her estate, which would be the conservator aspect you're talking about. Isn't that finding pretty much the linchpin of the argument?
I don't believe that it is, and I acknowledge Your Honor is correct. The order does say she's incapacitated for her person and for her estate, but I think the oversight here was that it was just a guardian appointed, and the guardian specifically, as defined in the code section, specifically has certain powers, and that guardian's powers are for the personal care of the individual, including medical decision-making, would be primarily in this case, but also for her care and for her residence. But the code section defines conservator as the individual or the person who would manage the estate. So even though there's a finding of incapacity, there is no petition for a conservator. There's just a petition for a guardian.
Right, but that point may well be a good point, but I don't recall it being raised at all in the trial court.
I didn't raise that specific point in the argument before the trial judge. No, I did not. And the court, on the basis of the Cook case and the precedents, said that there was a guardianship and that therefore that she should have filed in the name of the guardian. But again, in preparing for the argument, it occurred to me that a conservator. I mean, I did argue that it was limited for medical decision making, which would fit with a guardian, because a guardian would clearly make medical decisions.
But the conservator guardian distinction that you're now drawing, which, as I say, may be a good distinction, the trial court never had an opportunity to consider.
I did not raise the conservator. No, that is correct. I did not raise the conservator before the trial judge. But I did raise that it was, in my opinion, looking at it, I thought it was limited to medical decision-making. And the code section, 64.2-2009, does recognize limited guardianship for medical decision-making purposes. And the code section seems to encourage the court to take away as few rights as possible. The court can certainly grant guardian or conservator certain rights that they have to decide in lieu of the ward, but it seems to encourage that the ward would retain as many rights as possible. But I believe that without a conservator being appointed and with that a guardian's abilities would be restricted to just medical decision-making and personal decision-making, and therefore, in the absence of anything further, she would retain the right to manage her estate, which would include filing a lawsuit. Also, 2009 specifically says that under Section 4A4, shall specify the legal disabilities, if any, of the person in connection with the finding of incapacity, which seems to indicate that a person starts with a full panoply of rights, and then the court can certainly take it away and give it to a guardian or to a conservator. But they have to do that.
Is there a case law that clearly says that filing a suit, a chosen action, is an estate, a managing one's estate function, as opposed to simply making a personal decision? In other words, the guardian-conservator distinction you're drawing, where is it clear in the law that filing or not filing a lawsuit is a conservator judgment call as opposed to a guardian judgment call?
I'm not sure it's absolutely clear. I mean, I would simply argue that that if you're filing a lawsuit asking for money, that would have to do with money damages. That would have to do with an estate as opposed to a personal decision, especially since it defines, under 64.2-2000, when it defines a guardian's role, it defines a guardian as someone's responsibility for making decisions regarding the person's support, care, health, safety, habilitation, education, therapeutic treatment. It doesn't mention a lawsuit. I think it would fit more, there's nothing definitive, but I think it would fit more properly under an estate, again, where you're asking for money damages.
But then how do you address 2025 of that section, which talks about prosecuting or defending all actions or suits, and indicates that unless the court limits or puts conditions on it, that this is an appropriate function?
I mean, clearly, the case law in the section, I think it mentions fiduciary, the fiduciary must prosecute the lawsuit. I would simply argue that in this case, that function was not actually given to the guardians to prosecute the lawsuit. If it had been, then clearly the guardians would have to prosecute the lawsuit.
Right, but the statute's written in just the opposite. It doesn't say you have to specifically give it to them. It says, subject to conditions or limitations, the fiduciary can do this. And 2019 says the guardian stands in this fiduciary relationship.
Again, no question, if the guardian has those powers, then the lawsuit must be prosecuted in the name of the guardian. But again, I think we have to read this with 2009, where the court has to specifically take away the rights, or I think the rights are retained. It has to specify the disabilities and specifically take away the rights where those rights are retained. I know the sections don't exactly fit perfectly well together, but if you look at the way the whole section is constructed, I think they specifically, the court, guardian seems to take care of just the personal decision-making, which, and if we look at the background here, that's why the petition, it appears to be, that's why the petition, if you look at the petition for guardianship and then the order, it appears to be that's why it was pursued in the first place, to make medical decisions on her behalf. But at this time, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Paul Walkinshaw for the defendants. To answer Judge Kelsey's question to plaintiff's counsel regarding this distinction that he is making for the first time between a guardianship and a conservatorship, not only is he making it, did he not make it to the trial court, he has not made it to this court except for today. He did not present it in his brief, so not only was the trial court deprived of an opportunity to consider it and rebut it, but so was I and so was this court. And indeed, plaintiff's counsel did not even file a reply brief after I filed my opposition brief to his opening brief, where he could have raised this argument if he saw fit at that point in time. But that being said, I think it's a little neither here nor there, because I'm not sure, coming at it for the first time, whether it's clear in the law that there's a distinction to be drawn between someone that is under a conservatorship, someone that has power over their estate, and someone that does not have power over their personal decisions or that has a guardian appointed for them, whether or not that distinction has any bearing on being able to file a suit. But what is clear, I think, is this court's statement in the Cook decision, which is that it doesn't matter what legal disability the person is under. If a fiduciary has been appointed for that person, then that fiduciary must prosecute the action. And I think that the court was being very faithful to 2025, which says exactly that. The fiduciary shall prosecute the case on behalf of the incapacitated person.
Counsel, though, in Cook, the appointment order said that the person was, quote, incapable of understanding the simplest business transactions. That's a different fact than we have in this order, is it not?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor.
Where does it say that she is incapable of understanding the simplest business transactions or anything that's substantively similar to that?
It says in paragraph 1, appendix to page 26, respondent is deemed incapacitated and unable to care for her person and estate.
Keep on reading. Read the rest of that sentence.
Yes, due to, I can't pronounce that.
Panhypopituitarism.
Thank you. Marked osteoporosis and bilateral deafness.
Okay.
It also says
stop right there. The first condition, a pituitary gland that's not doing its proper function, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Second, some sort of osteo, some sort of bone-related condition, correct?
There is that, Your Honor.
Third, deaf in both ears. Tell me how those relate to unable to understand the simplest business transactions.
Well, Your Honor, by statutory definition, she is unable to understand the simplest business transactions.
We've had the discussion about the statute, conservator versus guardian, and that may be the prevailing argument. I'm certainly recognizing that. I'm simply saying, you're relying upon Cook, and Cook has a factual distinction between the circuit court order in that case and the circuit court order in this case, does it not?
I don't see it as a significant factual distinction, no. And I'm not relying on the statute.
Then explain to me, as I asked, the difference between paragraph 1 in this case and that finding of fact in the Cook case.
Your Honor, I believe that the court in this case, although it did not use the exact same language as the order in the Cook case, I will grant you that, the language is not exactly the same. It is perhaps not as descriptive in its details as this one is, but that doesn't make a difference because this one is broader and covers more than the one in the Cook case. Regarding the finding of fact, this court, the trial court found that Kenia Lopez Rosario is incapacitated and the duration of her incapacity is permanent. She is unable to care for her person and estate, and those findings are not surprising given what was submitted to the trial court with the petition for a guardianship. It is all over the petition.
Where is that? Just give me a joint appendix
citation
for it.
The petition, appendix page 18, states in paragraph 2 that Ms. Lopez is an incapacitated individual as defined by Virginia Code section annotated 372-1000. The psychologist reports that are submitted with the petition describe her severe cognitive deficits. She functions cognitively at about the level, and I'm reading from appendix page 23, cognitively at about the level of a six-year-old child. Estimated intellectual functioning is in the range of mild mental retardation. She cannot understand spoken speech, but she can understand and communicate in American Sign Language, though at the level of a young child. Her overall cognitive level, as best I could estimate, seems to be that of a young child, perhaps 6 or 7. Her condition is permanent and expected to remain stable.
Okay. Thank you.
Given those facts, your position in this case Actually, it doesn't depend on even that, does it? I mean, your, it seems to me your position is that she was declared incapacitated, and that's as far as you have to go, and now we have a fiduciary, and that's as far as you have to go. Is that your argument?
That is. That's how I read the Cook case and the statutes regarding this issue. Yes, Your Honor.
But you don't have to rely upon the Cook case, was one of the points that I was attempting to make.
Well,
there is a distinction between the Cook case order and this order.
In as much as there is a distinction from any one case to the next, and that the facts don't exactly match up from one case to the next, yes, but I do think that Cook is right on point. I also think the statutes are right on point, and that there is no reasonable basis to depart from Cook's holding, given the facts that we have in this case and the facts of Cook, nor to depart from the plain language of the statutes in this case. Plaintiff's argument centers on this point that this was a limited guardianship. But there is nothing in the order, and he doesn't point to anything in his brief regarding the language of the order that limits this guardianship. It was not proposed as a limited guardianship. The petition submitted to the trial court didn't say she can't handle her medical decisions, but she's okay to handle her personal affairs and her estate and other things. We just need a limited guardianship. The petition didn't say that. The order that the trial court entered doesn't say that. The plaintiff has not cited anything from the trial court's order that says that. There's just simply no evidence in this case that plaintiff's main argument that he presented to the trial court and that he has presented to this court, that this guardianship that was instituted for Ms. Lopez Rosario was a limited one. There's simply nothing there. For that reason, I ask that you affirm the decision of the trial court.
Thank you very much.
You.
Rebuttal? You have 6 minutes and 38 seconds remaining.
Thank you. With all due respect to counsel, I would say that it's on page 26 of the appendix, which the actual order begins on page 25. In paragraph 4, it states the co-guardians shall be responsible for the personal affairs of Kenia Lopez, Rosario. The co-guardian shall have authority, pursuant to the code section, to make decisions regarding the support, care, health, safety, habilitation, therapeutic treatment, and residence. So that's where I believe that the order specifically says here are the powers of the guardian in this particular case, which seem to relate to, again, medical and personal decisions and don't seem to relate in this paragraph, which is the key paragraph, that does not seem to relate to her business affairs or her estate. And I would also say, counsel did quote earlier in the appendix, page 24, from the evaluation of Ms. Lopez, where she was evaluated, and on page 24 of the appendix, under number 7, it says, in my professional opinion, Kenia Lopez is in need of a permanent guardian. The present petition arose from a requirement of, that's NCMC Children's Hospital, that someone have a legal responsibility for making the decision to permit Kenia's recent orthopedic surgery. So I would argue that this would indicate that it all arose from the need to have a decision for a guardian for medical decision making. It just wasn't even contemplated.
Let's go back to the list of actions that you read. First of all, appears to be an anomaly. When it says support care, there's no comma between them. You notice that there's a comma between each of the other ones indicating a distinct action to be taken. Would you conclude that that's a typographical error, or is there something?
That's a good question. To me, it looks like a typographical error. They meant support.
Okay, that would appear to be the case to me. So if indeed they meant that, does not support imply financial affairs or things of that nature? Care, health, safety, habilitation, therapeutic treatment, and residence are all relating to physical needs. But you're going to need to make the argument that that support somehow relates to that, and I'm not sure that it does. That's one of the one of the hurdles that has to be crossed for your position.
No, I would acknowledge that. I would say that support, in that case, would mean physical support, including, because she's living at home, and give her support living at home whenever she needs in terms of physical accommodations, taking care of her, carrying her around, making sure she's taken care of on a daily basis. I think support, as used here, would mean, in her context, would mean physical support because of her condition. She doesn't need a lot of physical support. But I acknowledge there is some question about what was meant by that. But I think if you look at, again, look at the whole paragraph, the rest of that paragraph, to me, clearly relates to physical, personal care. And so I don't think support would suddenly address financial needs out of the blue in that paragraph. There would have been a separate paragraph to take away all of her rights and to allow the guardians to pursue anything regarding financial needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.